Welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. This month, what's the point of the Olympics? How a brief writing exercise can make you a sucker for a cheap chat-up line? And did the Mormons have it right about polygamy the first time? This is the July edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk. With the Olympics finally upon us, it's time to celebrate sport. The TV schedules are fit to bursting with diving, handball, water polo, and a host of other sporting endeavours that nobody gives a toss about except for 2 weeks every 4 years. The fencers have sharpened their swords, the sailors have braced their mizzen masts, the cyclists have pumped their thighs to the size of sofas, and the synchronised swimmers are just happy that whatever it is they do is still considered a sport. So it's perhaps the perfect time to ask the question we're all thinking, what's the point? Yeah, there's the shot at glory, the gold medals, the lucrative sponsorship deals. But what I'd like to know before I dedicated my life to playing ping pong better than anybody else in the world plays ping pong so I could beat everybody else at ping pong and be the ping pong champion is, will this get me laid? Gail Brewer and Sharon Howarth of the University of Central Lancashire recruited 84 heterosexual women and showed them a picture of a man with average physical attractiveness. The man was described as either someone who didn't play sport, who played sport on a casual basis, played competitive sport non-aggressively, or played competitive sport aggressively. Women rated the man's attractiveness on a 10-point scale. The results showed that men who played sport aggressively were considered more attractive than men who played sport non-aggressively by about 1.5 points out of 10. Non-aggressive sportsmen were another 1.5 points more attractive than men who played sport only casually. But casual sportsmen were no more attractive than men who played no sport. Meaning that if you think lugging your beer belly around the footy pitch every Sunday is going to turn any heads, you're kidding yourself. If you want to boost your sex appeal, you'll need to start taking your sport seriously. And then punch someone in the face, apparently. Biologists think sport might serve primarily as a lek. That's what ethologists call a gathering of males for the purposes of competitive mating display. For example, peacocks form leks to show their tails off to the females, with the alpha male securing the best patch of ground to display from. Because the females encounter a whole bunch of males in one place, they're better able to judge who has the sexiest tail and who deserves to father their offspring. In this analogy, the Olympics is a giant $20 billion, 14,000 athlete lek, with Usain Bolt as the alpha male, while the 56-kilogram weightlifter from Micronesia is just glad he isn't selling peanuts to the spectators. There hasn't been much research into women's attractiveness in sport, but it's probably much less complicated. Three words. Women's beach volleyball. Are you a parking ticket? Because you've got fine written all over you. Have you got a map? Because I keep getting lost in your eyes. I may not be the best looking guy here, but I'm the only one talking to you. Chat up lines. Do they ever really work? The evolutionary scientist in me wants to say yes. How could natural selection allow such a terrible behaviour to persist if it wasn't successful at least some of the time? Believe it or not, there are people who do serious research on chat up lines, and they've identified three main categories. The first is a direct gambit. An example of a direct gambit might be, I'd like to get to know you. Short and to the point, this is the sort of line you might expect to be used by Tom Cruise, or an alien. Or to put it another way, Tom Cruise. The second category of chat-up line is the innocuous gambit, which masks interest. This could include things like, this band is great, or what do you do for a living? Or even, why does Christian Bale do that stupid voice when he plays Batman? Anything really, anything that conceals the fact that you're desperate for any form of human contact. The third type is what we all think of as the typical cheesy pickup line, what the scientists call a cute flippant gambit. Both men and women perceive people who use cute flippant gambits to be less trustworthy and intelligent. But there's more to chatting up than the person doing the chatting. The person on the receiving end of the chat-up line, also called the perceiver, has a part to play in the success of the interaction too. On a very simple level, the sex of the perceiver is important. Women prefer men who use innocuous gambits, and men prefer women who use direct gambits. there are other factors too, including something called self-regulation. Self-regulation is a bit of a tricky concept, but simply put, it's the ability to exert control over your own impulses, thoughts, and behaviours. High self-regulation equals greater self-control, and lower self-regulation equals lower self-control. And just like physical exertion, the mental exertion involved in suppressing desires, controlling your behaviour, and also deciphering the behaviour of others is tiring. After that Micronesian weightlifter I was talking about earlier has lifted his weights, he'll be too tired to lift them again. In the same way, if you're forced to control your behaviour, cognitive lactic acid builds up and you'll find it difficult to control and interpret behaviour later on. Gary Lewandowski and colleagues from Monmouth University in the US randomly assigned 100 students to one of two groups. All students had to complete a 5-minute writing assignment about a recent trip they'd taken, but students in one of the groups were forbidden from using the letters A or N. If, for example, they wanted to write a sentence that required the word and, they couldn't. They'd have to use the word plus instead. To show how tricky it is to string together a series of sentences without using the letters A or N, I'm going to try and do that for the rest of this podcast. Afterwards, oh no, that's not right. Later, no. Next, subsequently, no. When, following. Okay, turns out every word in the English language contains either an A or an N. So no wonder students given this limitation felt mentally exhausted afterwards. So anyway, afterwards, all the students were given a photograph of an attractive opposite-sex person, and they rated how they'd respond if that person approached them and started up a conversation using a list of typical chat-up lines. The researchers found that students who'd tired their noggins out with the tricky writing task found the cute, flippant gambit less appealing than students who'd done the easy task. Perhaps because they were no longer in any mood for fun and games and stupid jokes. However, students whose self-regulation had been depleted by the difficult task were somewhat more receptive to innocuous gambits. The researchers hypothesised that this might be because depleted self-regulation makes it difficult to determine another person's intentions. If intentions appear to be benign, you're more likely to take them at face value than if your brain was running at full capacity. You're more likely to think, hey, he seems nice. I mean, for someone who wants to talk about Batman anyway. Thank God he's not like all the rest of these guys, always on about sex. So maybe the best opening line of all is, tell me about a recent trip you've taken, but don't use the letters A or N. I want you to write for 5 minutes. The US presidential elections are on the horizon, and the Republican field has been narrowed from a selection of weirdos and nutters to Mitt Romney, who, for legal reasons, I'm going to describe as neither a weirdo or a nutter. Even though he kind of is. One particular aspect of Romney's background that's received a good deal of media attention is his Mormon faith, which some find perfectly normal. And it's fair to say, some don't. Admittedly, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints became a little more mainstream in 1890 when polygamy was scratched from the rulebook. Had the church retained plural marriage, they would have looked pretty peculiar to most Americans. But in fact, many anthropologists believe that polygyny, which is the form of polygamy in which one man has multiple wives, was common throughout much of our evolutionary history, and skyrocketed in popularity once agriculture gave men the opportunity to build up a store of grain and cattle and then trade them for what they really wanted, more wives. It makes simple evolutionary sense. A man can have lots of offspring only if he has lots of wives, since women can only pop a sprog once every 9 months. More wives equals more children equals more of your genes getting the nod from natural selection. A much more peculiar marriage system than polygyny is polyandry, or one woman with multiple husbands. One anthropologist in the late 1940s described polyandry as so rare that it was barely worth considering. Since then, multiple husband families have been identified as the norm in several pre-industrial societies, most famously amongst certain Tibetan farmers. The logic for that particular group seems to be that the land is so poor it can't support lots of one-husband, one-wife families. So brothers team together to work a single farm and share a single wife. The men might prefer a wife of their own, but they put up with sharing because a shared wife is better than no wife. Catherine Starkweather of the University of Missouri has scoured the anthropological and ethnographic research literature for further evidence of polyandry and its causes. She concludes that multiple husband households are far more common than previously thought, present in more than 50 societies worldwide. The clearest explanation of this marriage system is a male-skewed sex ratio. That's when there are too many men knocking around for everyone to have a wife of his own. Starkweather points to research done in the 60s on an Amazonian tribe called the Surui, whose female population was decimated by disease when first contacted by outsiders. This left the men with the option of fighting over the few women who remained, or deciding to share wives and just get on with it. Rather admirably, they decided to share. Historically, the Inuit and some South American groups practiced selective female infanticide, since parents perceived sons to be more valuable than daughters. And this sometimes led to double the number of male adults to female adults. Again, the men often preferred to share a wife than waste valuable hunting time squabbling over who should get to sign the marriage certificate. This emphasises another important point in establishing favourable conditions for polyandry: which sex produces the most food. When women produce much of the food, men probably have more time free to waste chasing women or aggressively playing sports in the hope of catching their eye. When, as with groups like the Inuit, the male produces virtually all of the food, there's less time for extracurricular hanky-panky or a vigorous spot of rhythmic gymnastics. In conclusion, Mitt Romney's wife should get a second husband. Newt Gingrich will be up for it. Dirty little silver-haired monkey. That's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to www.oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris.